We're back with Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. 150 years ago today, President Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address. It's become Lincoln's most famous speech and is one of American history's best known as well. It's only 272 words and lasts about 2 minutes, but since there's no extant recording of Lincoln giving the speech, we've enlisted Lake Effect's Civil War contributor Thomas Martin Sabatke.
47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or to detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
While it may be one of American history's best-known speeches, there's a lot that isn't commonly known about the context in which it was delivered, as Sabatke tells Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce.
What you have is 15,000 people descend on Gettysburg to be there for the speechifying on this day, and they don't have enough room for them. Here you have 2,500 people in a town, and then 15,000 people come to visit. And unlike the soldiers who will just lie on a hillside and get their sleep and eat something, these people expect to be in beds and to live in a civilized fashion as they visit the great site of this great battle. And here Edward Everett, the greatest orator in the North, probably in the whole country, give a two-hour oration. And the president to get some remarks. David Wills, one of the most prominent attorneys in Adams County, Pennsylvania, where it's the county seat there, invited both Everett, and he accepted, and the president, as he put it, to make a few remarks, not any great oration, but to be there and to make a few remarks. David Wills, who has it's a large house that's still there in Gettysburg on what's called the Diamond or the Square, and it's you can actually tour parts of it now as a museum. It's wonderfully been restored. Mrs. Wills was pregnant well along, so you can imagine in her confinement she didn't want these people coming in. They had 38 lodgers the night before the speech, 38, and they had people doubled and tripled up in beds. The only two guests in the whole Wills house, and these were where all the top politicos went to stay, to get their own beds were Everett and the president. It's kind of like, well, you're not going to make the president, you know, have to kind of get in with two or three other people that maybe he's never slept with before. These guys are the only two guys that get their own bed.
Why would so many people gather? Obviously, this huge battle occurred there months prior, but why would so many people turn out for the dedication of a cemetery?
Well, in Victorian times, you know, there were things like the good death, and people had immense respect for people who are grieving. We're 2 years into a great war, and nobody has gotten away with not seeing someone in grief for a lost loved one. And there's a sense and an understanding that the battle that last summer was a key turning point in that conflict. It's important. David Wills and people in the town of Gettysburg had bought land up on Cemetery Hill next to the Evergreen Cemetery, which was the town cemetery. And it was to be a national cemetery. And this is an independent effort, and it was working. They actually raised money, and they got the thing bought. And the government was going to come in, I think, and help along the way. And people wanted to be there because Edward Everett is a darn good orator. And they felt that this itself would be a remembered historic event beyond the battle months later in November. There was great interest, great excitement. There was a sense that because of Vicksburg that summer and Gettysburg in July of 63, that those might be turning points. There was great hope in the North that they had the upper hand. And there was a sense that this is something that you want to be there.
So this sounds like it was as much of a rally, if you will, to support the troops as it was to memorialize those who had been lost.
To some extent, that's true. Certainly all the ceremonies were very solemn. But the night before the speech, Lincoln does address a very enthusiastic crowd of maybe a couple of hundred people in the square right below him where the Wills House is today. And he made just a few remarks and a joke or two, and the crowd was happy. And I think they did. I think this is part of the excitement that, you know, this horrible war has gone on for 2 years, and now we think we've got the upper hand on the rebellion. And Lincoln said, basically, I've got the real thing is tomorrow, so let me make my speech tomorrow. And that's when he made some word changes. The last polish was done the night before, right before he went to bed. He actually was working on this speech quite hard, contrary to the idea that he just kind of did it on the fly. No, he actually had two or three different drafts that we're aware of. And he did not do any draft work on the speech on the train on the way, as much as I would love that to be true. The historians all agree that that was not the case. There's no information for that. The next day, it's very solemn. Because you asked a question about, is this more a celebration? But once they marched with troops and dignitaries up Baltimore Street, up to the hill on Cemetery Hill, when they gathered by the speaker's platform and got ready for the various parts of the ceremony that would open up and commemorate the opening up of this cemetery to the Union war dead who had sacrificed themselves for the nation. There was a burial party of a half a dozen people, and they were burying a number of corpses right next to this area. So I don't think those people would have been in a great mood. They would have been in an appropriately somber mood.
You point out a very interesting point, that this was a Union cemetery. And I wonder if that's something that gets lost in public memory today, that it wasn't Union and Confederate soldiers who were being memorialized in this cemetery. It really was for the Union side.
That's right. I mean, it wasn't something that people made a big deal about. But had they been pressed upon it back then, maybe somebody could come from our time and say, well, I'm glad we're honoring both sides, war dead, they'd be in trouble because this was to memorialize the people who fought and died to preserve the United States, not a Confederacy. So you've got that. Some of the people had to stand on freshly filled in graves to observe the speechifying. And there was a smell of death around the place. During that day, these 15,000 people went all over the battlefield looking around, and two additional corpses were found and then identified. There were still parts of knapsacks and canteens, and not as much as there had been that summer and early fall, but there were still some things there. This was a town that still was grieving, and the evidence of the battle was still to be seen and smelled. It was real. It was palpable. And so that's the atmosphere, and you start with Edward Everett for 2 hours.
And so what did Edward Everett say in this speech that most people today didn't even know there was someone else speaking, and actually that President Lincoln wasn't the main speaker that day?
Well, Edward Everett mainly kind of gave a play-by-play replay of the exploits of the Union Army at Gettysburg and made direct allusions to ancient Greek history. And it was a really good, wonderful speech for what it was to do. And he did speak for almost 2 hours. In those days, you don't have all the things we have today to entertain ourselves. And so people's attention spans were very much longer, and they were very much more tolerant of that. Of course, we all know, and it is true, I think Everett wrote to Lincoln and said, "You accomplished in 2 minutes what I did in 2 hours, maybe not even that." You know, it was kind of a thing where I think Everett, who is a great orator and speechmaker, understood that Lincoln had made a great speech.
And so Lincoln takes the stage. Everett finishes up.
Right.
Lincoln takes the stage. Did people know what the president was going to say? Did they have any idea of the kinds of remarks, or did they have expectations for what they thought he might say?
Well, they certainly expected and got a very respectful honoring of the war dead that were being buried in this new national cemetery. But they had no idea of what direction his remarks would take, none whatsoever.
We know the words of the Gettysburg Address, but what is it that maybe we don't always hear?
Well, one of the things that I've encountered in working with students at the university level and teaching is the difficulty with the first couple of paragraphs. But he refers to that 87 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. And, of course, the two things he identifies, that it was our country was conceived or begun in liberty, and it was dedicated to the proposition or devoted to the idea that all men are created equal. And then a couple lines later, he says that now we are engaged in a great civil war testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. I think sometimes a bit of that is lost to the public today when I work with them on this. I've actually confronted students and members of the general public. And what he's really saying is, look, we are going to give this American democratic experiment a second chance. And the question that's really in front of the whole country is, can democracy work? Every other country on earth that time was either a partial monarchy or a dictatorial one. And all these princes and emperors and kings and queens and their aristocratic nobility surrounding them in all these European countries, they were pointing at the U.S. and telling their people, look, this is what happens when the masses of the people try to govern themselves. You need to be governed by people of a higher sort, by those who are in the elite. And Americans, North and South, actually, this is where that would come in, but especially Northerners who are preserving the Union. What's often lost is that these men that died there, they weren't just doing that at that point for some empty thing. They understood. Everybody there at that speech understood that we were defying the world by trying to continue a representative democracy in the face of a world that very few, if any, nations had. That's what Lincoln's talking about. He doesn't know. Lincoln is thinking, and this is true, Lincoln is thinking, if we don't win this war, the Union does not prevail, this is going to prove that our whole democratic experiment is a total failure.
But was he not also referring to enfranchising and freeing the slaves?
Yes. At the end of the speech, he, of course, talks about a new birth of freedom. And here, historians even today are somewhat divided about that. There are those that are the skeptics that say, well, no, he was talking about the Union gets that second chance. We're going to have a new birth of freedom because the Union's going to be preserved. And in being preserved, the Union is going to give you a chance to have your liberty in safety and to have a country where all men are created equal. But anyone in that place that heard those words or saw them reported in the press knew he was also thinking about 4 million slaves who were in the process day by day being freed by the hundreds of thousands and then millions by the time the war was over. People knew that if the Union won the war, 4 million slaves would be free men and women. That's going to be a direct consequence. So when he says a new birth of freedom, I don't go with the skeptics. As a historian, I am out front and I say everyone understood that that not only meant the Union and its liberties and freedoms would be preserved, our democratic experiment itself, but that a whole bunch of people were going to get their freedom for the first time.
Thomas Sabatke, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thomas Martin Sabatke is a historian, author, and educator. He's also our Civil War contributor. His latest book is Richmond's Bloody Road. Coming up next, a Lake Effect essayist thinks the country has some soul-searching to do when it comes to the Civil War. She'll explain what she means when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.